Well, when I first started teaching, as you said, I think it was most often done through theory and teaching these complicated words with, you know, hard to understand concepts. And it never made sense to me, to be honest, as a student myself. And so when I began teaching, I would tell stories, whether they were about my own life or about my children, as a way to express the idea of whatever the concept was. And I found the students became so engaged and interested, and it made sense to them. And I think it also made it less frightening when they heard these diagnoses and different terms. It would sort of scare them, like, did that mean they were whatever the concept was? And I wanted to normalize it and let everyone know that these are experiences we all have. And I think it works well for teaching. It's been fun when I run into a student, even 25 years later now, who'll say, oh, I remember that story.
My students are overwhelmed with how much they're learning. They want to know what to say. How do you know what to say? And they're looking for a kind of formula for that. And I think the stories help to show how many different kinds of situations one can encounter with the work and what's happening in the course of a day and how spontaneous an intervention might be. And that, you know, when you were talking about learning to play a musical instrument rather than the theory, we're also learning to listen to the music. And I think the stories offer a way of learning how to listen in the layers that an analyst does.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful, and I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guests today are Dr. Anne Edelman and Kerry Malawista. And we spend our time talking about their recent book, When the Garden Isn't Eden, More Psychodynamic Concepts from Life, a book that was also written with Linda Canefield. And this is a continuation of their storytelling project, and that is, how does one best communicate what the dynamic process is? And we spend time talking about the importance of understanding theory and the importance of also playing the instrument. Dr. Edelman is a clinical psychologist and training analyst at the Washington Baltimore Center for Psychoanalysis and the Contemporary Freudian Society. She is the co-editor of the Journal of the American Psychoanalytic Book Review section, where she launched a feature column called Why I Write. She is co-chair of the New Directions in Writing program and maintains a private practice in Chevy Chase. Her books include Psychoanalytic Reflections on Parenting Teens and Young Adults, Changing Patterns of Modern Love, Loss, and Longing, Also, the therapist in mourning from far away nearby, along with Carrie Malawista. And their first book in this series of storytellings, Wearing My 222 Analysis and Other Stories, along with Carrie Malawista and Catherine Anderson. Carrie Malawista is a training and supervising analyst at the Contemporary Freudian Society and a board member at the Washington Baltimore Center for Psychoanalysis. She is also a co-chair of New Directions in Writing and founder of the recent project, The Things They Carry, which offers virtual writing workshops for healthcare and frontline workers across the country. She's on the permanent faculty at the Contemporary Freudian Society, and she teaches widely. Her essays have appeared in many publications, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Baltimore Sun, the Boston Globe, to name a few. She is a co-author of Wearing My 222 Analysis and Other Stories, and also The Therapist in Mourning, and a book in 2017, Who's Behind the Couch? And she has a recent novel that has just been published. It's called Meet the Moon. And she and I are going to have a conversation about that down the road a little bit. That's her first novel. We have a really lively conversation about the role of storytelling in learning dynamic thinking. And they read some of their stories and we unpack what they have to teach us about the dynamic process. I enjoyed it. It's I've recommended it to the residents I teach. It's really a valuable way to learn, but it's not just for beginners. They bring a really a lively touch to what can be at times an awkwardly dense subject. Here is my conversation with Carrie Malawista and Anne Edelman. Carrie and Anne, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you both here. You know, those of us who are involved in teaching the dynamic therapies are faced with a challenge. The challenge is that we need to introduce conceptual thinking, the theoretical basis of how the treatment works and how the dynamic mind works. And at the same time, in doing so, we run the risk of suggesting that this is an intellectual, if not intellectualized, process. And the analogy that speaks to me is that we need to teach music theory without losing sight of the fact that our intent, our purpose, is to teach people how to play an instrument. And they're both very different skill sets. Even further, that in teaching theory, we run the risk of suggesting that there are rules. But in fact, in learning to play an instrument, we intend to teach that there are guidelines. And the two of you, in your two books, have faced this challenge through the use of storytelling. Your first book, called Wearing My 222 Analysis and Other Stories, Learning Psychodynamic Concepts from Life, and your current book that we're going to spend time on today, When the Garden Isn't Eden, More Psychodynamic Concepts from Life, which you've both written along with Linda Canefield, address this really with a delightful breath of plain English. So let's start by chatting with each other about the challenge of teaching the dynamic therapies. And then I'm going to ask each of you to recount some of the stories from the book. You'll each read one, and they're brief, and then you'll summarize one other. And we'll use it to flesh out how storytelling really invites the listener to appreciate the dynamic mind and how the dynamic therapist can involve themselves in that dynamic mind, often using one's own personal history. So what's it like teaching dynamic therapies?
Well, when I first started teaching, as you said, I think it was most often done through theory and teaching these complicated words with, you know, hard to understand concepts. And it never made sense to me, to be honest, as a student myself. And so when I began teaching, I would tell stories, whether they were about my own life or about my children, as a way to express the idea of whatever the concept was. And I found the students became so engaged and interested in, and it made sense to them. And I think it also made it less frightening when they heard, you know, these diagnoses and different terms, it would sort of scare them. Like, did that mean they were whatever the concept was? And I wanted to normalize it and let everyone know that these are experiences we all have. And I think it works well for teaching. It's been fun when I run into a student, even 25 years later now, who'll say, oh, I remember that story about whatever. And I know it stayed with them. So that's where the idea for the tutu book came.
That's a great example. I remember that story. That's really, you know, we often, and we'll talk about this because it comes through in the stories, we often wonder, how do we know an intervention is effective? And it's, of course, not if a patient says yes or no, but here, and there's an example that we'll hear in one of the stories about somebody who comes back years later and reflects on one of your interventions. And just what you said, I remember that story, is really testament to the power of storytelling. And you have an experience?
No, I was going to say that's also a really good point, too, that I think a lot of the time, because students are overwhelmed with how much they're learning, they want to know what to say. How do you know what to say? And they're looking for a kind of formula for that. And I think the stories help to show how many different kinds of situations one can encounter with the work and what's happening in the course of a day and how spontaneous an intervention might be. And that, you know, when you were talking about learning to play a musical instrument rather than the theory, we're also learning to listen to the music. And I think the stories offer a way of learning how to listen in the layers that an analyst does, that it's a story that has many, many layers to it.
That's a wonderful example. And again, the stories, as we're about to delve into, really demonstrate that beautifully. Why don't we start? Carrie, your first author, why don't you start us off? You have one of my favorite stories in the book, Intoxicating Power. Why don't you read it and we'll flesh it out, because it's just a little snippet of an exchange, but there's a volume that we could discuss in it. So why don't you start us off?
Okay. 23 and petite, Stephanie routinely arrived at her sessions wearing baggy sweatpants and collared shirts buttoned up to her neck. Her clothes, too large by a size or two, looked as if she had worn them to bed. Her long hair hung in front of her face like a curtain, hiding her from the world. At times, she appeared so timid and waif-like that I felt the urge to reach out and offer her my hand. Listening to Stephanie, I sensed her strong need for reassurance and encouragement. She reminded me of what it felt like to be the last girl picked in gym class, and I felt enormous compassion for her. Stephanie filled our early sessions with the myriad ways she felt badly about herself, as if to convince me that she lacked any valuable qualities. Yet I found her likable and engaging. She was intelligent and had a good sense of humor. And when I could see beyond the clothes and hair, I saw an appealing young woman. She described her childhood with an unhappy and unfulfilled mother who resented giving up her career to take care of her children. Her mother's depression and denial of Stephanie's sexuality and attractiveness still resonated with her. And even though Stephanie secretly believed her father favored her over her older sister, she rarely interacted with him during her teen years, when he retreated from his nagging, depressed wife, leaving Stephanie to pick up the pieces. Stephanie told me that she had no interest in dating. In fact, she fended off any attention from men. Quote, no makeup, nothing revealing, was her goal. She worried that if she looked at all pleasing, she would be seen as, quote, sleazy or seductive. I could easily imagine her alone on a weekend night, sequestered and depriving herself of the social pleasures of other young adults. In those first months, we explored her dramatically low self-esteem. I struggled to understand why she felt so undeserving. She would return to her list of deficiencies like it was a mantra. She was not smart enough, not interesting enough, not attractive enough. While I was tempted to contradict her, I refrained because I knew that reassurance would likely offer no real relief or change. Even so, I would gently steer the conversation in a direction that would reveal her positive attributes. I kept thinking that if she could see her potential like I did, she could begin to build a more hopeful view of herself. After a time, Stephanie's oft-repeated self-criticisms began to feel decidedly redundant and hollow. The sessions deadened. My empathic comments made little difference to her self-perception. As Stephanie persisted in presenting this narrow and negative view of herself, it gradually dawned on me that there was more to this story. One afternoon, Stephanie arrived visibly upset. "I hate that Charles is paying so much attention to me. He's always trying to talk to me," she cried, her eyes downcast, her nose running. "Oh, it is so awful. I can't believe he flirted with me like that. Why would he even be interested in me?" she sniffled. Suddenly, something in me shifted. I felt like I was watching a performance. "You know," I said, with a lifted eyebrow and a bit of a smile, "I'm not sure I believe you." She looked up, her eyes wide for a second. "What do you?" And she stopped mid-sentence. Then she began to laugh, a deep, hearty laugh, the first I had heard since her therapy began. Her face brightened, her shoulders relaxed. "You're right. It's not really how I feel at all. I actually love it. You know, it sort of feels better to admit it. I really do love the attention. I can't believe I'm telling you this." After that exchange, our work started to shift. Stephanie revealed her secret fear that she had a, quote, intoxicating power over men, end quote. She worried that if she, quote, let herself go and revealed her beauty, she would seduce men and cause destruction like Helen of Troy. Instead, she chose to keep her body and its longings tightly under wraps. Stephanie recognized that she was conflicted about drawing attention to herself. With friends, she would act demurely and self-effacing, but secretly she would flirt and try to capture a man's attention. We came to see that her hiding her wish to be noticed was a way to protect herself from other women's envy and rejection. Only later did she confess to having envious and competitive feelings herself. Gradually, Stephanie began to inhabit the space in my office more fully. She started to take pleasure in her wit, her intelligence, and her instinctive flair for fashion. I marveled at her transformation and the ways in which she had become both thoughtful and playful in our sessions. It was getting harder and harder to remember the insecure young woman who arrived at my door just a year earlier.
And I've read that story so many times, and I so enjoy it because it's such a lively demonstration of what happens in an ongoing dynamic treatment. In particular, your reference to your inclination to reassure her. She tries to draw from you this sort of sad sack persona and to present it to you. But then as you write, you said something shifted in you. Can you say more about what that is? Because that's the pivotal moment. You sort of said, wait a second. She is not listening to herself as I am able to hear her.
Yeah. I mean, it had been growing where the sessions had begun to feel so deadened and they weren't moving anywhere. And there was just a moment, I guess, where I even felt it in my body that I felt like I was watching a performance on stage and it did not feel real. It felt like acting. And I just thought to take the chance and say, you know, which is a little more confront, you know, I'm not sure I believed you, but I felt I had enough relationship with her. You know, it's again, like the intuitive part of the work. You just have a feeling someone can hear something.
Well, it's like Anne said, there are spontaneous moments, and this is a wonderful example of it.
One of the things that I really love about this story is that, you know, a lot of people who are just starting as therapists or as, you know, in their clinical work, they think about, you know, empathy as being kind or supportive or offering, you know, a chance to, you know, see it through the patient's eyes, which of course we do want to be empathic and we do want to try to see the experience through the patient's eyes, but that doesn't necessarily mean just staying alongside of them, that sometimes a comment that is more, well, like Carrie's saying, more risky, or, you know, when you have a relationship or you feel like you've understood something, that itself can be a very empathic comment. And I think this woman experienced Carrie in that moment as understanding something that she didn't even feel she could fully articulate.
Right, that you want to be empathic to another aspect of the person that they're not aware of.
Right. Or almost aware of. She was almost aware.
And that is a hard thing to teach.
Yes.
Yes. How to be attuned to that part of the patient that they're not aware of just at the moment where they can just about hear it. Knowing full well that we all err in both sides of that. We do it too early or we do it too late. Sure.
Yeah, because some people think of psychoanalysis, you know, more as a science, but it's really in the room an art, you know, in terms of like a good, you know, you play by ear and what you're hearing and when you respond. And that is hard to teach, or, you know, you can learn the technique, but can you do it with
can
the
you
art?
Improvise? Right. Yeah. It's the improvisation. Yeah. Yes.
Or it's like we're bringing together the technique and the improv. Mm. You can't really just create the art if you also don't have the underpinnings that help guide your listening.
Right. That one really needs to understand something called the repression barrier, for example, to understand when it's softening and when it awakens something in you.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And it goes without saying that, perhaps it goes without saying, but I'll say it, that an essential learning process in all of us coming to be able to do this with patients is to have experienced it ourselves, to be a patient in an improvising scholarly treatment setting is a vital part of developing our own instrument.
Right. And I think often what I think of as the best interpretations is what after the next session, when either you or the patient don't remember who said it, That's a sign to me that the work is going well. When you both, you know, when you're not aware who made the interpretation, who made the comment.
That's a great example. Yeah. And you have the next story called Lost Cat. Why don't you start us off with that?
All right. It was 4 weeks after my father's bicycle accident that he awoke from a coma. At the time, I was just 23 years old, and I hadn't fully grasped how devastated I was. Each day, I would picture him either flying over his handlebars or on a breathing tube. And each night I dreamt that he was speaking to me, reassuring me that he was fine, that it wasn't nearly as serious as everyone thought, and that he wanted me to get him back home. Of course, he wasn't fine. We soon learned that he would never recover from the massive brain damage that would impair his mobility, eradicate his speech entirely, and render him completely dependent on others. For weeks after the diagnosis, I'd wake up in tears. I didn't want my boyfriend to touch or comfort me. I felt numb and as cold as stone. When an older friend suggested that I go into therapy, I stared at her, bewildered. It had never occurred to me to see someone, although I had been considering getting a degree in clinical psychology. After more persuading, I scheduled an appointment. I cannot remember a single thing I said during that first session. All I recall is that I talked for the entire session nonstop, never giving the therapist a chance to say a word. He looked kind, however, and I really didn't care whether he spoke or not. I discovered to my amazement that I had a lot to say. For the first time since my father's accident, I felt at peace, even liberated. I readily agreed to return the following week. One day before my second meeting with the therapist, my boyfriend called to tell me that he had lost my cat. He had agreed to take my cat to the vet while I was at work. And instead of taking him in the car, he placed the cat in the saddlebag at the rear of his bike. He didn't feel right closing the bag all the way, so he had left it partially open. At a busy intersection, the terrified cat jumped out of the bag and disappeared. As he told me what happened, I grew more and more furious, unable to stop replaying the scene in my mind of my trembling cat dashing through busy traffic. He kept apologizing, and I yelled at him, "How could you do that? What were you thinking? Why did you have to ride your stupid bike?" By the time I entered the parking garage of my therapist building that afternoon, I despaired of ever finding my cat again. I collapsed into his reclining chair and started sobbing. Bit by bit, I related the story of my rage and grief over losing my cat. The therapist listened in sympathetic silence, murmuring a mild mm-hmm now and then, and offered me a box of Kleenex. I spent the second session talking about my cat, the first pet I'd ever had, who was dog-like in his devotion and would follow me around the house, carrying my smelly gym socks in his mouth. It seemed I couldn't bear another loss. Finally finished with my outpouring, I sat hunched in the chair, spent. For the first time, there was silence in the room. I awaited his wise and comforting words. Looking at me with large sad eyes, he cleared his throat and said, "Cats are such sensitive critters, aren't they?" I froze. Suddenly, I thought of Max, the boy I had a crush on in the fifth grade. The crush abruptly ended when I watched him being bullied on the bus, and once off the bus, when he was no longer in danger, he stuck his tongue out at his adversary. He looked pathetic. I had to look away, unsure if I was protecting him or me. I picked up my tissues, walked out my therapist's door, and never returned.
It's such an intense story. And I read this one a number of times as well. You and I have a different take on it. My take is when you say about the boyfriend and the cat, you say, "Why did you have to ride your stupid bike?" It seems to me that that's a reference to your father. And then when the therapist says his, quote, pathetic comment, you froze, which tells us that something's happening in you. And then you say, "Suddenly," which also reaffirms that something's happening in you, you had an association to Max, the boy you had a crush on, perhaps like one's father. And he, Max, looked pathetic, as your father, perhaps with a breathing tube, looked pathetic in a disturbing way. And you associated that to the therapist, who was then pathetic, and you left. And these kinds of things have happened to all of us. I, on a good day, would have liked to have said something to the effect, "Do you feel so strongly about what seems like my pathetic comment because of how upset you feel about your father appearing so pathetic to you?" That's different than finding the therapist actually being pathetic, as opposed to focusing on what was happening inside the person in the story who was reacting like that. How does that sound to either of you?
Go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I thought the therapist, there was no time. It happened towards the end. She had the feeling and left. And right, if a therapist could have followed up and noticed that.
Right. I mean, I think the issue is a little different than that. I do agree those are the layers in the story. I think that's very clear. The story is about a kind of misattunement. And almost you can think about it in terms of, you know, how do you, at the beginning of a relationship with a new patient, how do you find your way to understand, you know, how to track them and respond to them at a given moment? And I think, so you're absolutely right. It wasn't that the therapist per se was pathetic. Who knows, might have turned out to be a very good therapist. Hmm. But it was a moment of misattunement. And might that have been known or not? I think we'll never fully know. But I think it was more about how do we learn how to listen, not just to what the content and what the associations might be, but to the emotion too, and where is somebody at a given moment. So, I mean, while I agree with you that the comment itself might have stood alone fine, it was still not what she was talking about. Mm-hmm, the patient was talking about a loss. The therapist was talking about something that landed in a different tenor.
Okay. It's the musicality is where you're also.
Yeah, I guess it's the musicality, yeah.
Yeah. Carrie, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, and another patient might have heard it as just right. I mean, that's exactly the other thing. That for you, it felt weak, critter, and, you know, the feeling of it was it missed where she was, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And hopefully we have a chance to catch that, though. You know,
right?
But there wasn't, you know, where we then say noticed how the person reacted. And then I think that can save a therapy.
But and which is also, in a way, another teaching opportunity from the point of view of reading the story, because, of course, we don't have success with every patient. Sure. And, of course, we're often left not knowing what happened. Why did a patient not come back? What was it that we said or didn't say, or, you know, where was the mismatch, or was it something else entirely? And I think that's another piece to learn to come to terms with as a new clinician.
Mm-hmm. And the stories provide so much to chew on. That's what's so lovely about the book. In reading through the book, I noticed that there were two stories that you each handled differently. They were stories that touched each of your personal histories. And Carrie, you decided to share your personal history with the patient. And Anne, you decided to not share your personal history with the patient. And how about, instead of reading it, you summarize the story and tell us your thinking, your reflections at the time and since, and how you came to decide what you did, and would you do it differently? Just for us to play with it. And Carrie, your first story is the limo ride.
Yeah, the limo ride is a story about Mary, a 9-year-old girl who had come to me after her mother died of cancer. She was an only child and very sad little girl, but very withdrawn. And her father brought her to therapy because he found her getting, rather than, you know, coming back to life somewhat after the mother's death, was really withdrawing further. And she was similar with me. Rather than play with other toys, she would just mostly sit there, you know, sometimes drawing, but pretty withdrawn. And I felt it was hard to make much contact with her. And then one session, she was drawing a picture, a new one, and it was of a large black car. And I just made a comment that that was a very fancy car she was drawing, and it looked like a limo. And she said this was the car they drove to her mother's funeral in. And she kept drawing. And it was at that moment that I was so struck by this limo. And I had recalled my mother died when I was 9, actually in a car accident. And I remembered having the fantasy of the excitement of driving in a limo and how pleased I was, which was clearly a way to compensate trying to find anything good in this experience. But I felt such shame. I mean, just horrific shame that stayed with me for years, that how could I be pleased to ride in a limo? And I just, again, intuitively used that and thought, I remember my first thought was, I could have done what I usually do, what a patient would say, you know, I could imagine a child might be excited to ride in a limo and then go to, you know, something about it. But in that moment, I recalled how many times Mary talked about no one else knew what this felt like. She didn't know anyone else who had lost their mom, and she was so alone. And I decided at that moment to tell her just in that way that it's not something I had told her before, but I thought it might help to know that my mom had died when I was 9. And I remembered being so excited to go in a limo and felt so ashamed. And, you know, again, these sound like magical moments, but it was quite a turning point for this little girl because she looked so relieved and then began talking just about that feeling, how terrible she felt that she had wished to drive in a limo. So it was an unusual choice for me to tell something about my personal life, particularly losing my mother. But then I do tell in the story that it was, we don't often get a chance to learn how our comment is, but Mary came back. She asked to see me once when she finished college. This is like 10 years later. And, you know, she told me how she was, again, not surprisingly, wanting to go to medical school. She was going to attend medical school and wanted to be an oncologist. And then she talked about that the one thing she remembered distinctly was my telling her this and what a relief it was, what it meant to her to hear that my mother had died and my thoughts of the limo. So.
Have you told people since then or children since then?
You know, I haven't felt the need. It's interesting. And I knew in telling her, I felt very sure there was nothing in my need for my own purposes to tell it, because I think that's the risk. Sometimes we share things more because of our own personal need to divulge something. But I can't think of even another need to do it, but it was just that choice with her at that moment. And I still, even without hearing the confirmation later, with right. the work with her, I felt very sure it was the right thing to do.
Your usual response, it sounds like, would have been to perhaps be attuned to what your experience was and to have reminded yourself of how shameful and guilty someone would feel enjoyably riding on a limo to one's mother's funeral. And you would have said something like, I could imagine that you felt so uncomfortable enjoying the ride in the limo to your mother's funeral.
Yeah, right.
But, right. Mm-hmm. But there was something with her and between the two of you that led you to add that personal comment, which was useful for the work together.
Yeah, and I felt I would have just been depriving her of this feeling that she needed to know she wasn't the only child that way. And here was someone I knew, even though she was quiet with me, that she liked me and felt mm-hmm. you know, some attachment to her, and that I could be someone had lost my mother and be this grown-up that she, you know, admired and could see. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But most times, you know, I think of another man I saw who came to me in his 70s, whose father died when he was 9, but he wasn't even thinking about his father at all in the treatment, but he had multiple affairs throughout his marriage and he kept living this secret life. And with him, I knew that feeling of imagining the parent is still living somewhere else. So I said to him, you know, I could imagine a little boy could think his father was off living somewhere else and had a secret life. And again, it was that almost same moment like Mary, he was shocked and said, I thought that all the time. And he thought his father was still living elsewhere. But with him, I didn't need to feel the need, you know, I didn't feel that need to say why I knew that.
I think we all do that. We all use our childhood experiences, hopefully childhood experiences that have been thought through, analyzed, and like you nicely point out, can be used in service of the treatment, not in service of one's own need to display oneself, which is right. where the whole conversation about self-revelation sort of gets tied up in knots when people don't distinguish between it being for self-aggrandizement and for the needs of the patient.
Right.
Now, Anne, you have a story where similarly something in you is awakened and you manage it differently, the story of the ugly shoes.
So this was a patient who, a woman in her 30s who had a young child and was very harried all the time and very overly cautious and overly, you know, she was very, I can't think of the right word, to, you know, my authority seemed, you know, to permeate her world. She was very tentative with me, I guess. And so, you know, she would always, there was always a hint of, might I have done something that injured her? And in fact, the reason that she came to treatment was, I mean, she had worries and she was anxious and she had troubles in relationships, but underlying that, she had had, she'd been in a car accident when she was very, very young. And in that accident, she had been, her nature of her injuries left some scarring. And even though she had had a lot of procedures over the years to address the scarring, and by the time I met her, it was nearly invisible, for her, she felt, she continued to feel very scarred. And she felt like everyone who would meet her would immediately be curious about her scars. There was something about her, her feeling that, you know, was I, that, or my feeling, I guess, that I was about to harm her if I moved too quickly, if I said something too much. I found myself speaking in a very quiet voice with her. That I also got, I had this strange preoccupation when she lay on the couch about her shoes. Her shoes struck me as, you know, dowdy and frumpy. And I would have this, you know, preoccupation in my mind. Why is she still wearing those shoes? And I, you know, it's almost like a thing that just caught my attention in each session. And I thought, well, you know, maybe as she gets better, she'll dress differently and she'll have better shoes. I didn't really think that much about that particular, it just was, you know, but I was very aware of how scarred she felt. What she had not been as aware of is how much pain she had endured as a child in the course of these many, many, many procedures. And one day when she was talking about a particularly difficult procedure, she started to talk about how her mother was taken out of the room and not allowed to be with her, and how she was frightened and in pain. And as we started to talk about the pain, I started to muse on an early experience I had had as a child with pain, where my feet were born, malformed, and I had to wear these special shoes. And I just started thinking about that experience. And I suddenly, like, it all came together, why I was so focused on her shoes, why her pain had been sort of slipping kind of underneath in a way, but not on the surface. And so as I understood my own way of lining myself up with her, it freed me up to listen to her in a different way. And rather than experiencing her as so fragile, she became much more dimensional to me. So that was an example where I wouldn't have shared it with her, for one, because it wasn't really about, I was the one who was distracted by my experience. It wasn't really, and it took me a little bit to understand all those pieces. And it wasn't really about my experience. It was about what freed me up to listen better to her experience. And so I guess in a way, if it's about, you know, would I have shared it? In that instance, I wouldn't, not because it felt too private, because it felt more about my work with her, not about her work, if that makes sense.
Sure. You were sort of supervising yourself, if you will, or analyzing yourself, and your process, it sounds like, your process of recalling your history brought something different from you to her and the work, so that she could then symbolize what was otherwise left in concrete form. Like Vulcan talks about a linking objects that are concrete things that represent some past memory that can't get processed. And by freeing up through your reverie your own history, you could help her decathect this scar and dance in good legs and good shoes.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And I was thinking how the shoes reflected how this young woman saw herself. And I imagine because of Anne's experience wanting to disidentify mostly with that and see it as other, but once she could identify with it, her own vulnerable, you know, or feet, it allowed an opening.
Right. Yeah. Because of course, because of my trouble with my feet, when I was, you know, growing up, I did have to wear what I thought of as very ugly shoes. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, her shoes were the shoes that any young mother might wear, but I was sort of, I had overlaid something that I had to kind of work through until I understood it wasn't her ugly shoes at all that were bothering me.
Right. Both examples are really so lovely about something that might seem like it's about the issue of self-revelation, but it's really not. It's about each of you doing the work you needed to do. Carrie, you were using this experience of yours to reach her. And Anne, you were using this experience of yours to unpack something in you so that as a result of that, you could then reach her. And it's a great example of how we do the work. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about yourselves. You know, we all come to this work through our own stories and our own journeys. Each of you, like all of us, have our stories. Carrie, you want to start us off? Give us a sense of what you're doing here as an analyst, as a storytelling analyst, and also as a novelist.
What I'm doing, you mean where it originates or where?
Well, you're what brings you internally, what brings you to this place in your life of being attuned to stories and using them as an analyst and as a novelist?
Stories, yeah. Well, I think, you know, as a child, I was always reading novels. And I think I learned most about psychology through novels, in a sense that I think a good story, character development can tell you more than a case study. Mm-hmm. So I think that is where my interest in story came from. And I came from a family, not a strong education background, but more verbal, oral stories. My dad, who was more of a blue collar worker, though, when I was a child, would ask me what my dreams were like. And he said dreams had meaning.
So, yeah, I remember you telling me that. And I that was such a remarkable story. Yeah. Blue collar, white collar. I rarely know parents who are not in the mental health world who have that attunement to dreams.
Yeah, he had a psychological thinking, but without any of the language and maybe without any of the jargon or
Right. Storytelling,
so
right.
I absorbed that. It was through stories. Right. So, yeah. And then I became involved with New Directions in Writing, which is a writing program which changed my life in many ways in terms of writing. And now, like with Anne, I'm a co-chair of it. And I became more and more interested in writing stories. And then, as you mentioned, the recent novel I wrote, which took it to another level.
Yes, we're going to have another conversation about you and your novel because I'm in the middle of it and it's just marvelous.
Thanks.
But that's for another time. Anne?
Well, I would say, like Carrie, I was also a huge reader as a child. I would walk around with my book, my book up when I was eating, prop my book up everywhere I was. And I had a real love of that. But I also grew up kind of surrounded with stories and with writing because my parents had a typewriter store in Manhattan on the Upper West Side.
Another little wonderful factoid. They had a typewriter store in the Upper West Side
of
New York?
Upper
West Side, a typewriter store. Boy, there's a flash from the past. Yeah.
Well, truly, it was quite a unusual business when I, you know, as I grew up and I understood, you know, all of the people who passed through the doors of my father's store. And my father was a big talker, loved people, loved to talk and reflect. And so people, you know, a lot of authors, well-known authors would kind of gather in the store on a Saturday morning and just kind of hang out and talk with each other and talk with my father. And I would be sitting just kind of absorbing it or pecking away on a typewriter. But I think it had particular meaning to listen to the stories because my parents' story, their own personal stories, were very hard stories. They were both Holocaust. They're both in the Holocaust. My father was a Holocaust survivor. My mother, slightly different story, but still had fled the Holocaust. And they really couldn't tell those stories very well. And I think in some ways I've always been in pursuit of putting those pieces together into a story that can make sense rather than fragments that don't really make sense to a child. So I would say that became the impetus, really. It was woven into all of my work with trauma and grief and loss and with children. And then, you know, like Carrie said, we both found ourselves at New Directions and have been doing a lot of writing ever since then.
Can you tell us something about New Directions? I suspect many of our listeners will not be familiar with it.
It's a wonderful 3-year low residency program, 3 weekends a year. And it started for therapists to help them write without jargon and more clearly by Bob Weiner and Sharon Alperovitz actually started it. And they had this idea, bringing in writers and therapists to improve the writing in our field. And since that time, though, students are not only therapists, it's maybe 60%, and we have academics, poets, journalists, and we have analytic topics for the weekend, like the one coming up in November's mentalization, but we always bring in writers to bring in that component. So it, and it's a very tight group, very supportive, a lot of publications from it. It's a really wonderful group.
It's a very unusual program too. I don't think there is anything quite like it because even, you know, the conferences are analytic, but they are also interspersed with writing groups and writing workshops and lots of opportunity for feedback and for sharing writing and reworking and revising.
It sounds wonderful. And as you're describing it, I'm picturing your book and it seems like such a natural outgrowth of that.
Yeah, that's where it came. I was actually sitting at a weekend, I think in 2008, and I thought, I've always taught through stories and I always thought those were the most helpful. I thought, what if I did a book where you had stories and reflections? Mm. And it was at that moment. And actually, the writer Dan Menneker was there. If people know him, he was passed away not long ago. He was a publisher at Random House, but a writer. And I called him and told him the idea because he encouraged therapists to write. He wrote In Treatment about seeing an analyst. So he kept wanting us to share our stories. So his encouragement actually went into the Tutu book. Mm-hmm.
And these stories in particular, because for each weekend, there's an assignment of a 750-word piece to submit on the topic. And so these pieces themselves become stories that illuminate so much about how analysts think, whether personal stories or clinical stories, which is what we did in the book, trying to intersperse both clinical and personal memoir, you know, a range of ways to show how we think.
It's a good place to bring in Linda Canefield is the third author, and she wrote much of the reflections and brought in much more of the theoretical thinking too to the stories. So,
is there a third volume in the works?
I'm not sure. I think we covered a lot of concepts.
You certainly
unless
did.
Harvey, you could come up with 12 more concepts.
Listen, I want to thank you both. This has really been a treat. Certainly reading the book is a delight. I recommend it. Again, the name is When the Garden Isn't Eden, More Psychodynamic Concepts from Life. And it's published by Columbia Press.
Yeah.
And thank you both for this. It's a pleasure to not only read your work, but to get to talk to you.
Yes. Thank you, Harvey.
Thanks, Harvey. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.